Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. The name refers to the fact that the state isn't red or blue, it's both. I'm KUNR senior correspondent Bert Johnson, filling in as host today. And I'm joined by two political reporters, KUNR's Lucia Starbuck, and from our sister station, KNPR's Paul Boger, who are maybe a little relieved, or a little sad, that the 120-day biennial legislative session is officially over. Paul, Lucia, thanks so much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
First, I want to ask you both about the overall vibe of this session. What has been the mood in the Capitol over the last 4 months? Lucia, let's start with you.
I would say it's been pretty dark, and I think I say that because I kind of cover the health angle, and so there's kind of been this dark cloud over the legislature, and that I think that really stems from some of the potential Medicaid cuts. That's kind of what kicked off the session was, you know, potentially Nevada losing nearly $2 billion from Medicaid. Essentially is how we started the session, with this kind of worry hanging over lawmakers' heads. And you kind of saw that play out throughout the session. You know, people who were asking for money were feeling very nervous. I know Paul and I ran into an elected official on a mental health walk around the building, and he was talking about doing a bake sale. So you kind of saw like a lot of things just straight up asking for money, wait until the very end. Some things did make it through, like funding for eviction diversion, funding for outdoor education, so like gardening, beekeeping, bird watching classes for kids. But kind of overall, this kind of dark cloud hanging, I think, a lot from the federal government. And I know Paul covered an hours-long meeting where they talked about what they did during the recession and the pandemic.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting this session is that prior to the session beginning in February, we had this two-week period where lawmakers sat down with the governor's office to look at the governor's proposed budget, and then to also look at the state agency budgets, look at their requests, and really get the ball rolling on the budget conversation much earlier in the session than what we've seen. What we saw very, very early on was there was going to be money issues pretty quickly. The governor's proposed budget was not where it should have been, very reliant on one-time money, very reliant on funds that may have been used. We weren't quite sure where it was. Then you had all of the state agencies going through their requests. It just became very clear that there wasn't going to be the money to fill all of the requests for funds. So that put a dark cloud. Then we had conversations about movie tax credits. Then we had a conversation about what we would do during the recession. Like Lucia said, that was a dark meeting where lawmakers were sitting there going like, listen, here are all the things that we saw coming in the year leading up to the recession and the pandemic. And here are all the drastic cuts through state government that we made just to keep state government afloat. Nevada was the hardest hit state during the recession. And that was played out in those slides and in that presentation. And so immediately you have lawmakers and lobbyists knowing we're looking ahead towards perhaps dark times if this is a recession. Now, when it came to the actual money projections, Moody said we may stave off a recession if things with President Trump's trade war progress and get better. We're kind of seeing that, so we may avoid a recession, but still there was cautious optimism at best in the beginning. By the end, it was pretty much just, we'll hope we'll make it through this.
And as Paul mentioned, that meeting where they talked about what they did during the recession, similar thing with Medicaid, you know, an hours-long meeting, just hearing like worst case scenarios. You heard from like the rural hospital partners, you heard from community health organizations, just like if we were to lose this Medicaid money, like we'll be very dark times.
The governor's already wielding his veto pen. And as of today, June 6th, when we're recording this interview, Governor Lombardo has rejected more than 30 bills. That's lower than his record-breaking 75 vetoes after the last session 2 years ago. But what has he tossed out so far? What could be the governor's political motivations for this?
So he's already rejected things that were already sent to his desk 2 years ago, similar legislation that he's essentially just saying no to again. And some of those things are rent control for seniors. He's already vetoed two of the three kind of big firearm bills. One bill would have prohibited people convicted with a hate crime from owning a firearm for a certain amount of period, and then people under 21 from possessing semi-automatic firearms. So he's vetoed those two. He'll likely veto the third then, which is the prohibiting guns at election sites within a certain kind of radius. A couple other things I wanted to point out. So LGBTQ+ advocacy organizations are pretty upset too. He vetoed two bills. One would solidify, create policies for transgender incarcerated individuals in jails. And then another would have protected gender-affirming healthcare providers, basically prohibit Nevada from working with other states if those providers were maybe subpoenaed in another state, like it would protect them from working in another state's investigation. His policies are a little bit kind of all over the map because last year he signed a bill that would add protections for transgender inmates in prisons. So he didn't do it for jails. He also signed a bill protecting reproductive health care providers from getting in trouble for other states and things that are legal in Nevada. So he's kind of a little bit all over the map. We know that he is going to run for governor, and I don't know, I'm already celebrating the election. It's already begun for me, the 2026 election, but anything that he did during the session can essentially come up during the campaign.
He also vetoed a series of bills that would have created observation days or observation months. You know, these are pretty regular things that lawmakers do. One of them would have made Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day. That has drawn the ire of a lot of people who claim Italian heritage. He vetoed that one. But he also vetoed, you know, making a bill that would have made July Muslim American Heritage Month. He vetoed October being Menopause Awareness Month. He vetoed a bill making Dolores Huerta Day. So several of these sort of observational or awareness sort of months have been vetoed as well. That's actually interesting, you know, considering the DEI conversation that's been going on nationally. And then you've got SB 102 that would have made being a fake elector illegal in this state. That's really interesting considering we have seen the president take interest in maybe pardoning some of the people who took part in the 2020 election, naming President Trump the winner of that election, despite all the evidence proclaiming President Biden won that election. We've seen the AG press criminal charges against those folks. So it's interesting to see that bill once again be vetoed by the governor. We'll see if it comes back in 2027.
Yeah, and the AG had told me that would have added clarity to the laws. And Lombardo vetoed it last time because he said that the penalty was too harsh. The penalty this time was less, but he was like, oh, you know, people are going to get in trouble for kind of making their political thoughts known. Yeah, I'll be curious to see if that comes up again.
Only one of Governor Joe Lombardo's bills fully made it through the legislature, and that was his housing bill. What was included in that, Lucia?
So that's a pretty wide-ranging bill. It kind of just, I would say, like throws money at the issue. It's a total of $183 million for what he's calling attainable housing, and that can go to governments, that can go to nonprofits, that can go to tribal entities, and it can be used for rental assistance, for down payment assistance, for construction of attainable housing. And then another interesting thing that he did, and I'm using the word attainable because it changes state law to go from affordable to attainable housing. It changes that definition. And then it also expands who can qualify for attainable housing. It raises that area median income to 150%. So an even wider range of people who are maybe making a little bit more money, but just having a really hard time becoming a homeowner.
During his State of the State speech, Governor Lombardo also promised to prioritize, quote, the use of every buildable acre of land for Nevadans, not out-of-state investors looking to cash in, unquote. Was the legislature successful in putting guardrails in place against corporations trying to do that?
No. So that issue was kind of interesting to follow. I interviewed Senator Dina Neal, who was on Purple Politics at the beginning of the year, and she brought back again a bill that the governor had vetoed because he's kind of called it arbitrary. It would have set a limit to the number of single homes that large corporate landlords can buy to about 100 per year. That bill died during the session. Republican Senator Iyer Hansen kind of stood up and said, hey, it needed 2/3 of vote instead of just a simple majority. And he said, you know, the governor's office asked me not to sign this. There's going to be something like that in his housing bill. So Hansen ultimately killed that bill. There was an amendment to Lombardo's housing bill to do something similar, and that amendment never made it through. And so it's kind of this interesting fight that got set up in the beginning of the session because Democrats were quick to point out what Lombardo said in his speech, like, oh, we have the same thing. We want to take on corporate landlords. You know, a lot of talk about like every day, maybe a first time home buyer can't really compete with a large corporation. So, but they ultimately did not get any of that passed this session.
I see. And Paul, another huge topic of discussion was federal public lands. So where does that conversation stand right now?
Interestingly enough, we're about in the same place we were pre-session. There was a fairly controversial resolution, AJR 10, which would have essentially proclaimed support for this new Clark County Lands Act that's been going through Congress. That's Senator Catherine Cortez Masto's bill. That piece of legislation is controversial in that public lands activists, environmentalists proclaim, instead of the more concentrated approach you see in the Washoe County public lands bill, where there is some growth in the urban areas and public land, but a lot more conservation efforts in rural parts of the county, the Southern plan kind of just looks to expand the circle, right? It just makes the area of Las Vegas bigger, is what they say. So when that resolution came forward to support that measure, a lot of environmentalists were up in arms. Of course, we saw some bills to try to limit the amount of groundwater rights that are continuing to be used around the state. That did move forward, but all the way around when it comes to public lands or really environmental issues, I think we have a cloud seeding program that's been expanded through the Desert Research Institute, another interesting bill. But yeah, there wasn't a whole lot when it came to officially dealing with public lands.
Let's pivot now to education. Governor Lombardo worked with Democrats to get some of his priorities in that area through the legislature. So what did they accomplish together?
So education is really one of those interesting issues where I think that both sides are really going to claim a victory here. Sure, we did not see the governor's education bill move forward, but we saw large portions of that bill be picked up and essentially placed in Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro's Educate Act. Her bill focused much more on expanding pre-K, which she did get. We saw a number of her measures to expand access to early education throughout the state, whereas the governor's provisions in the bill dealt much more with the accountability aspect of schools and districts themselves. One of the big things in this state is that while schools are judged, while schools are rated by the state, districts themselves are not. In this new provision, in this new law, or what is very likely to become law at this point, that would change. You know, the state would have much more ability, much greater ability to step in with schools and with districts and say, hey, this is what you're not doing right. We're going to come in and step in and say, this is how you need to fix it. We're going to show you how to fix it. Sometimes even come over and take over the district if needed itself. So that is a big, big win for the governor. But also, it's in the Senate Majority Leader's bill. So both sides are going to say, hey, we came together, we compromised, we passed good legislation. They're both going to go into 2026 saying, we win.
A victory for everybody there. Lucia, let's talk a little bit more about some of the other bills that Governor Lombardo was behind for this session. He had an economic development bill, which was chock full of tax breaks, but that died without a hearing. And his health bill didn't make it past the finish line either. What happened there?
On the very last day, kind of in the final moments of the legislature, Republican senators voted against Lombardo's health bill. Republican Senate Minority Leader Robin Titus told us that it was because of this last-minute amendment by Democratic Senator Fabian Dagnotte that prohibited freestanding emergency departments from being like within a five-mile radius of existing hospitals. And Titus essentially said like those freestanding ERs serve like a very important role. You know, it helps kind of offload patients during like really busy times, and you would effectively be killing these freestanding ERs. So she voted against it, but that bill did a lot of things, too. It initially proposed about $60 million for graduate medical education. Kind of as Paul said, where parts of his bill was lifted and carried into another bill, that did get passed through a different bill at a lesser amount. But it also had a couple things to do with prior authorization, which was a big topic this session. And that's kind of the process where insurance approves procedures that it'll cover. He prohibited requiring that for some emergency services, like an ambulance ride, or if someone's life is at risk. Another last-minute amendment, actually, it would have shortened the timeline. So right now, state law says insurance companies have 20 days to respond. Sometimes they respond quicker, but 20 days when maybe you need some treatment right away. So it had proposed to shorten that response time to 2 days, but ultimately it didn't make it.
This session, like in previous sessions, lawmakers have tried to increase the number of healthcare providers in the state. One bill that can potentially have a huge impact is Senator Dagnotte's immigrant doctor bill. Tell us about this and what it means for healthcare.
Yeah, so that was an early piece of legislation that the governor signed. It essentially allows people who were licensed in foreign countries who have served there, now that they're in Nevada, they can skip the required residency program. They still need to take like U.S. medical exams and practice under a trained physician for 2 years. They also need to be English proficient and have a job offer before they can apply for an independent license to treat patients. And advocates told me that they identified at least 70 people in Las Vegas who would benefit from this bill, who can serve patients quicker. For context, residency programs take about 3 to 7 years. And just also very interesting in kind of the immigration context, I asked a lot of sources for that story. You know, you're having a lot of anti-immigrant sentiments, especially coming from the president and the federal government. And this kind of stands against that to say, not that you need to justify being in this country, but that immigrants do contribute in a very meaningful way. And to see the governor sign this kind of sees him stand by that too.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know that you also cover rural healthcare needs. Did that come up during the session?
Yeah, so there's some drama there. Early in the session, I asked the rural hospital partners kind of what key legislation are you looking at? And the president, Blaine Osborne, had told me he's looking at one that would allow rural critical access hospitals to get a trauma level 4 designation. So that provides more training and education on how to like respond to those types of emergencies. They talked a lot about like the golden hour, that you want to try to treat someone as quickly as you can, especially with a very serious trauma need, like maybe it's like a car accident or like something like that out in the rurals. So super exciting. They'll get this designation. And then by the time I go to interview Assembly Member Greg Koenig, the bill is essentially gutted into a study, which in legislature talk is like not what you want to happen to your bill. And so I asked Koenig kind of what happened, and he pointed fingers to the Culinary Union. He says there was the dispute in Las Vegas where two hospitals kind of in close proximity both got a trauma level classification, and he said that they helped kill the bill. I reached out to the Culinary Union. They declined to comment but sent me a statement from another organization that it essentially said like too much trauma care is a bad thing. And there's not a lack of trauma care in Clark County. Like, we are talking about like rural Nevada, like a large geographic region. So my story came out. I was like really nervous, kind of scared that it just kind of pissed off everyone in the process. And as legislature went on, it reverted back. So now rural critical access hospitals, they do need to request to the state that they can get this designation. It's not automatic. You must not be within like 80 miles or more of existing facilities that offer trauma care. But if you're in rural Nevada, you are pretty much safe from that limit. So that was, I think, seen as a big win for rural Nevada.
You're listening to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm Bert Johnson, joined by political reporters Paul Boger and Lucia Starbuck. They're breaking down what lived and what died during the 2025 Nevada legislative session. Paul, Nevada has some of the most archaic property taxes in the United States. You were following one bill that would have helped alleviate some of those issues. What happened there?
So you're talking about AGR 1, and that bill would have essentially said that when Nevadans go to sell their home and someone purchases a home, that the property taxes are assessed at the time of the sale, and then continue to depreciate from there. The way it works now is that depreciation level is set at construction. So if you have a home that's 50 years old, your property taxes are already the maximum amount you're going to pay ever. They're set for life. Now, the reason that would be so important is that the way the system works now is it's really based on growth. You want a whole bunch of new homes to really sustain the same amount of money that you're making as a government. This would only have been affected if people sell their houses. Taxes in the Nevada legislature are a very dirty word. No one wants to hear it. No one wants to talk about it. And Nevada has very strict constitutional amendments about how we can raise taxes and who is subject to them. So it's a very serious topic in the state. And I don't think that at this point, when you're also having a conversation of, are we about to go into a recession? What are people going to need to do? How are we going to save money? Any sort of conversation about taxes is just, what's the word I'm looking for? Verboten.
Taboo.
Verboten. Awful, terrible, no good, you know, horrible. I think that's why that bill died. I still think, as a political reporter, it was a really interesting concept. I think it is long overdue in this state, and it probably would have helped at least a lot of the locals raise much needed money in the coming years.
That's interesting what Paul said. Like, also with an extremely high cost of living, like, very hesitant to put any of those costs on people, on Nevadans. You saw extreme opposition against Sparks Mayor Ed Lawson's toll road proposal. Yes, there is like really bad traffic on your way to the industrial park, but like, why would you put that on the people, on drivers, on like, why do I have to pay for that, basically? So an extreme hesitancy to do anything like that to people.
Yeah, people certainly don't move to the state to pay more taxes.
Ed Lawson, very interesting, also supported HR 1. So,
as you both have mentioned, federal tax cuts are looming. But there was a film tax credit bill in this year's legislative session, but it failed. So why was that a casualty?
I think there were a few reasons why that was a casualty. Of course, the money issues the state is facing was probably the biggest factor, right? It's hard to go to your constituents and say, hey, yes, we gave this industry $100+ million a year in tax credits. Sure, they don't start for a few years, but like, that's good business. Sure, kids can't read, but that's good business. I think it's really hard to do that. I think it's also really, really hard to justify the sudden growth that would happen in the Las Vegas Valley that you would see from a new industry like that being birthed in such a small space, 31 acres in Summerlin. Finally, I also think that there were competing bills. You had Sandra Hyde's bill that was backed by Warner Brothers Discovery and Sony Pictures Entertainment. And then you had a bill that was backed by the original developers, Bircher and Senator Roberta Lang. And I think that's why you saw the film tax credits able to get through the assembly and then hit a stone wall in the Senate. I think Roberta Lang, who is the former chair of the Nevada Democratic Party and a state senator, was able to convince enough of her colleagues that her bill was better and should have been had more consideration. I think you had that. I think you had opponents of tax breaks in general. And then I think you just had bad optics. And all of it was combined to be a death knell for what 2 years ago would have been a probably a very successful bill.
If you want a little BTS, I think it was like 8 p.m. on the last day. It's a group of us, like journalists, sitting around the table. This amendment comes. And it's turned into a study. And you just see a complete shift. The table
the tone
almost,
of the whole building shifted.
The table itself dispersed to go tell our editors.
The biggest name lobbyists in the building all of a sudden were walking from across the street and from their offices across the street into the building, all on cell phones. And it was ominous. They knew their bill was dead. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Nevada voters can expect major changes at the polls next year. So, Lucia, one last minute proposal took a lot of people by surprise. What was that all about?
Voter ID. Prepare to bring your ID to the poll next election in 2026. Or if you mail in your ballot, be prepared to put in your driver's license ID number or the last four digits of your social. This is proposed by a Democrat. Democratic Assembly Speaker Steve Yeager in the hearing kind of said it's likely going to pass again. You know, a majority of voters supported that during last elections, a ballot question. And he said this gives us time to kind of properly implement it and kind of iron out the kinks. But this is really, really surprising considering he has reiterated that he would do nothing to kind of add barriers to voting, access to voting. Opposition to voter ID say that that's what this does. You know, some people might not have IDs. It kind of just creates an extra step to try to vote. You even saw some county clerks kind of raising concerns about, you know, putting those numbers on your mail-in ballot and then mailing it. If it was passed during the middle of the session, it probably would have gotten a lot of attention because it's a really big deal, but because it kind of happened last minute, there was just so much that happened that it was just kind of like wrapped up in everything. So I just think that was a really, really surprising move.
Yeah, and that's obviously been a goal of Republicans for years, and pressure around voter ID laws really ramped up after the results of the 2020 presidential election and the big lie that President Trump was sharing around the country, claiming falsely that the election had been stolen from him. Do you think that Assemblyman Yeager in this case has done enough to appease his Republican colleagues on that issue? Do you think they consider this a victory?
Definitely. And then again, there was some opposition because it wasn't even a new bill. It was like an amendment tacked on to an already kind of big election bill. And Republicans also didn't really like, kind of, it seems like as a trade-off, the governor had vetoed a different election bill by Yeager, and this was also added back into the amendment, ensured that there's drop boxes between the last day of early voting and the first day of election day, kind of in that weekend when you can't really do anything besides mail in your ballot. And they brought up concerns about drop boxes in general, which, you know, they are secure, they are monitored. And then another thing that I think maybe he tried to do to appeal to advocates is if you do need an ID, you can get one for free if you need it to vote. So kind of this weird middle ground, but I know that progressives are pissed.
Now that some of that dust has settled, what are you two going to be looking out for now? Paul, why don't you lead us off?
Well, of course, you know, we have to get through the remaining vetoes, see exactly what makes it to law. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen at the federal level when it comes to federal support of states. Of course, we have the Medicaid question. I don't think there's really much doubt at this point that lawmakers are probably going to be in a special session come this fall to deal with the financial fallout associated with federal cuts. So I think there's that. I also think that after that, we're going to be dealing pretty much with election season. Lucia is right. She said it earlier. It's already started. Midterms are here. Nevada doesn't have a big midterm this year in that we don't have a Senate election. So we're not going to be quite as on the radar as we've been in other elections, which means this is going to be an election pretty much about just state issues and local issues. It's going to be really exciting to cover. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what gets brought up. And everything that just happened in the last 120 days of the legislature is going to be absolute fodder for those mailers that we're all about to get bombarded with.
Yes, 100%. The election is here. You had people announcing that they're running for office in the middle of the session. Also kind of curious to see where some of our state legislators, if they decide to run for higher office too. Yeah, I like how Paul put that. It's going to be a very Nevada-centered election. Statewide offices are up, governor, AG. Also just curious kind of, yeah, what the mood is in a year. You know, last election, people are talking about high prices. They can't afford gas, rent, food. So if they're still struggling or struggling more because Nevada can be in a uniquely impacted situation just because of its reliance on tourism. And then just kind of curious to see the money that did get approved, where will that go? That $183 million from the governor's attainable housing bill, you know, can that really solve Nevada's major housing crisis?
That was KUNR's political reporter Lucia Starbuck and sister station KNPR's political reporter Paul Boger. I'm Bert Johnson, and you've been listening to Purple Politics Nevada.